On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We're joined now in studio to have our deep dive through the Sunday newspapers by John Isle, who's Deputy Business Editor of the Irish Independent, and by Elise Hand, Food Critic with the Sunday Times. Thank you both for coming in. Good morning to both of you. We will talk more about that Sunday Independent lead story about the handling of the Catherine Zappone appointment, but also now some cabinet leaks around it, which is possibly a bigger story. We'll get to that a little bit later, but firstly, just off the back of hearing from Damien McCallion this morning, Elise, I'll start with yourself. There's an awful lot written today about vaccination in today's papers, about getting to the end stage as it comes to adults, but possibly the larger battles that the HSE will have when it comes to trying to convince teenagers and perhaps children further down the line to get vaccinated. Anything that jumps out for you in today's papers?
Yeah, well, I think we were all very heartened to see the long queues outside some of the vaccination centres yesterday, young people queuing up to get their jab, and it was a great sight. And I think one of the, as you rightly point out, I think HSE will have to be on their guard over the next while. For an issue that's dealt with in the Sunday Independent, there's a large piece on page 14, just looking at the necessity for a publicity campaign just to address vaccine hesitancy. But understandably, parents particularly are obviously anything to do with their child and medication, you know, they would be more worried than if it was to do with themselves. So they're very ripe for falling victim to misinformation and so on. And there is quite a lot of it out there. I've been doing some work on this over the last 5 or 6 or 7 months. So, you know, you can basically break it down into various categories of misinformation. And you have what I'd call the conspiracists, and they would be they'd be the people who you'd believe that it turns you into a magnet and that you can get 5G through your brain and all that. Right. So then you have what I'd call the sort of pseudo medics. And again, that would be a lot of the wellness crowd, the sort of the pseudo doctors or real doctors that just peddle disinformation, that talk about things that are in vaccines and, you know, that aren't in vaccines and how they can change your DNA and all that.
By the way, is that done in bad faith, or do you think that they just misunderstand some of the information that's put in front of them and that they're mistaking correlation for causation and the likes?
It's a mixture of both, but I think there's a lot of just bad faith there, a lot of bad faith actors. And there'll be a lot of grifters as well that are just trying to turn a buck out of it. And you see a lot of this, particularly in the wellness end of the industry as well. This is particularly prevalent in the US. And you'd quite see a lot of this on Instagram, people saying you don't need a vaccine at all. You can cure COVID through various, you know, combinations of vitamins and over-the-counter medications.
Are they vitamins then that they will attempt to sell you? Is that the whole ruse here?
Oh, absolutely. They will have handy links to a website where you can buy this for $9.99 or whatever. Okay. So there is that. Then there's probably the water cooler misinfo. And this is the most difficult one in a way to combat, because you get a lot of this, say, through WhatsApp groups and again on Facebook. And this is very much, my sister's neighbour, their child was found dead on the floor after getting, you know, a vaccine. And here's a picture to prove it. And it'll be a picture of that nothing relates to anybody dying of vaccine. And this is very hard disinformation, because it's that sort of narrative. It's the I heard, the hearsay stuff. And that's very hard to combat. And that's all over Facebook and WhatsApp. And then there's just the far right, which would be the anti-everything. So they're anti-vaccine, they're anti-everything. And almost they use anti-vaccine as a way to kind of get people into their mindset. It's like everyone's trying to do you down. You don't need the vaccine. And this is sort of the dangerous one. I mean, we saw a protest in Dublin last weekend, sizable turnout. But the worrying thing is that the speakers at that rally, almost every single one of the speeches that I went through was just anti-vaccine disinformation and misinformation. And quite a lot of like rhetoric. So the HSE really need to be aware of this, that there are parents feeling a bit vulnerable about getting their young children vaccinated, and they need to be out ahead of this, you know, across all those categories.
John, I'll ask you in a few minutes if there's anything that jumps out in from you in the papers. But I suppose one point that Lee's touches on there is that it's actually quite an interesting time for the role of media in general, because if the HSE wanted to launch an anti-disinformation campaign, usually you'd think that they would try to use the means of the established media as the way to do it. But if you have so many people who are being misinformed by that sort of water cooler discourse or something that they heard that someone else had told them of someone who'd had a bad adverse reaction, when it's sort of, you almost have like community transmission of misinformation, it's very difficult to use central media as a way to counter that.
Yeah, I think the viral metaphor you just used is a really good one. Social validation is so important to these efforts. And you can see it across your own social media. I dipped into Facebook the other day and came across something. It was a kind of an Irish anti-vax site that had imported a lot of messages I would have been familiar with from kind of American quasi-Christian motherhood and apple pie type discourse, right? Which is pretty alien, I think, to this culture, at least as I understand it. And it was really pushing this idea, the valorization of motherhood, that mothers in particular, not just parents, but mothers in particular, are the sort of like the primary defenders of childhood wellness, and that nobody, not doctors, not public health officials, not governments, could possibly know more than a mother. And what I think is being smuggled in there through this anti-vaccine discourse is like a reinstantiation of the traditional family model where mother knows best. And I kind of think that there's a little bit of that creeping in. But I'd be very optimistic, actually, based on what's actually happened so far in Ireland in terms of vaccine take-up, which has been incredibly encouraging, like very high levels among the adult population, that people will look at this in a pretty rational way, for the most part, and vaccinate their kids at similar rates to which they vaccinated themselves. And, you know, we've seen the statistics in the last week showing Ireland getting close to about 3/4 of the adult population taken care of, and at the older, more vulnerable age groups, near unanimous vaccination, which to me is a great sign, and like far better than what's happening in the United States, where you have in entire regions where vaccination is below 50%. You have these repositories of the virus. So I think like one thing that has been very nice for me to see in Ireland in the last year and a half, although it's been hard for everybody, and we all know the ways in which it has been a very pro-social attitude of this country. Like what I like about Ireland as someone who moved here, 20 plus years ago, is like the smallness of this country makes it easy to move quickly and to move together. And there is actually quite a lot of social cohesion and social consensus, I think, around COVID, notwithstanding all of the kind of, let's say, fringe or marginal attacks on the HSE or NPHET or whatever.
But given that it's a small country, though, does that not make us also more susceptible to having some of that water cooler misinformation doing the rounds? Does it not mean that it finds it easier then to grow roots and to spread because everyone knows everyone? So if someone has an adverse or a bad experience, that someone knows someone who knows someone, and suddenly it's in everyone's frame of reference.
Yeah, possibly. But I can see what you mean by that. But I think you're much closer here to the people who are making the decisions about you. So in the US, Washington is a really remote place for most Americans. Dublin,
so Fauci or the CDC is thousands of miles away, and they're so removed from your life.
Exactly,
and so on.
And like, let's not forget the way American government presents itself is very impersonal. The governance model here is quite personal, I think. This is one instance, I think, where maybe the parish pump is worth having. So I'm just trying to present here, I guess, what I see as a kind of a positive side, not ignoring the various issues that you see, especially in social media and the WhatsApp groups, where a lot of like folk wisdom gets passed along and people get scared. Social validation does matter in small groups, especially. And let's say young mothers might be especially susceptible to scare stories. But I think as long as the public health information that comes out is consistent, right, which it hasn't always been, as long as it's consistent and rational and makes sense to people, I think for the most part, we're all going to get vaccinated.
Lise, I'm struck that, and this might be something that you'd have some experience of because of your time knocking around Leinster House with the likes of me, that maybe actually the idea that Ireland is the receptacle of clientelist parish pump politics, maybe it means that actually TDs could have a very constructive role where they're minded to actually do so, to go out into their communities and try to explain to people that some of what they've heard about the negative sides of vaccines just doesn't stack up.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite extraordinary to be saying this, but yes, the fact that the TDs are so embedded into their constituencies and would have a high public profile now, whether that is also, they're also afforded respect, of course, is another complete question. But I think there is that sort of network. I think John, has hit on something. I think there is that sort of network is important, that community leaders and people that do actually occupy various places of respect. It could even be things like people who run sports clubs, GA clubs and stuff like that. Mm. Like they have, you know, they've always been great at stepping up to the plate at, you know, when something is needed, and they would have a huge role to play as well. And, you know, it is interesting, I think, that when a lot of the young people were interviewed about why they were getting the vaccine, you know, it wasn't just because I want to go on holidays. It was because, you know, I want to make sure that my family are okay, you know, my granny and granddad are okay, and I want to kind of resume life and play sport and not have to worry about it. So I think that sort of community network and community ethos is very strong. And I think that is a good way. Mm. It is the best way to combat, the online disinformation. It's just that online is awash with it. So, yeah. I mean, it is a constant battle.
Well, I suppose then it's the other thing, too, is that it's not always possible for community leaders to take a leadership role, because if what you're seeing is from the other side of the world, then it's very difficult to sort of deal with that torrent. I did say to John that I was going to ask him to pick out something from the papers, but actually I want to draw a line on the vaccination chat here, because after the break, we're going to talk about the story that's on the front page of the Sunday Independent and was touched upon yesterday in the Irish Times. You consider it as you know, salacious and outrageous gossip from the corridors of Leinster House. You could also consider it as outrageous, full stop. John, during the ad break, you had what might sound flippant, but was actually kind of a very useful point about trying to rally people behind the cause of vaccination.
That's right, yeah. On the second page of the Sunday Times today is a story, a headline, Young Help Ireland to Pass UK Vaccine Tally, which is probably the best public relations campaign you can have for getting vaccine take-up, is to say, you know, look, we're ahead of the Brits on this. And if we want to win, we're going to have to get the jabs in the arms. And it also points, I think, to something, an important difference between Ireland and, let's say, the UK and the US, which is that vaccines have become a part of the culture wars or the political wars in both of those countries. You know, so if you where you land on Brexit or where you land on Trump really tells you where you're going to land on vaccines. And I think for the most part, that kind of semi-psychosis has really bypassed Ireland, at least for the moment.
And I noticed that Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, didn't waste any time. He was up on the Twitter machine yesterday pointing out that we're beating the Brits. So it's green jerseys all around.
Well, they can beat us in Olympic women's hockey as long as they like, as long as we've got slightly more jabs in our arms than they do. Although Tony's been in touch also on Twitter to point out that it's not all plain sailing from here on out, because Iceland, despite having 86% of its population fully vaccinated, has had to reintroduce some restrictions because new cases are soaring there as well. And that, by the way, is a country that requires fully vaccinated passengers still to pass an antigen test 72 hours after they arrive. So a little bit of work still to be done, but certainly we seem to be in a good place. I want to talk about the story, as I mentioned, on the front page of the Sunday Independent. And there's two angles to this. There is, first of all, the substance behind the appointment of Catherine Tupone as a government envoy during the week and whether that was an appropriate appointment to begin with. But it's been slightly overtaken now by a question mark about how that news emerged into the public domain in the first place. It was first reported by the Irish Examiner on Tuesday lunchtime as Cabinet was still meeting. But the Sunday Independent explains to us today, and this was hinted at a little bit by Miriam Lord in her column yesterday in the Irish Times, that a senior cabinet minister, somebody who was at the cabinet table, spoke to a junior minister and expressed their concerns about this. The junior minister replied to the effect that they agreed and that they had just been on local radio to complain about it. A few minutes later, that junior minister was then contacted by a journalist who said, "Oh, one of the guys in the office has just heard you on radio. Can you just confirm again what you'd said?" The whole point being, though, that the junior minister had never been on radio at all. It was a deliberate lie passed on to a cabinet minister to try, potentially, to weasel out the source of a cabinet leak, which, Lise Hand, as I said, you could either treat it as being outrageous gossip, or you could also treat it as being outrageous full stop.
Well, I mean, it can be both. There's absolutely no reason why it can't. And I suppose as a you know, long-time former parliamentary sketchwriter, I mean, you know, it's the sort of story that certainly I would enjoy from that point of view. And it actually was broken by Miriam Lord in her column yesterday, which inexplicably wasn't sort of flagged on the front page, because it really is a good story. And she correctly and somewhat hilariously did compare it with the Colleen Rooney, Rebecca Vardy sting of 2019, which was more or less exactly sort of run along the same lines. You know, Colleen Rooney put stuff out there.
For people who don't get all the news via Instagram, this was a situation where she was trying to find a mole, so then started putting up misinformation on Instagram, hiding the audience so that only one person could see it, and then seeing how far that lie would get out.
Yes, and then there was this sort of dramatic denouement where she kind of announced that, you know, allegedly Rebecca Vardy was the culprit. Rebecca Vardy took massive umbrage to this, and the case is currently rumbling through the high courts in London. But, I mean, you know, there is a similarity. And it's, I mean, you know, so that's extraordinary in itself, the actual way that this was done. But it does point to the they have been plagued by leaks coming from cabinet. Mm. I mean, this is, you know, which is a serious issue because cabinet confidentiality is obviously, you know, something that they take very seriously because there has to be one place that people can air views and knock ideas around a table without thinking that it's not only is it going to make the papers, but it's going to be tweeted out in, you know, while the cabinet meeting is ongoing. So
people might have become passé to that because it now happens for parliamentary party meetings all the time. But I think it's important to underline that they have different significance in our sort of political structure. A PP meeting is basically a club.
A PP
cabinet
meeting
is where a country is run.
Yeah, I mean, a PP meeting, look, is where people can let off steam and they can throw shapes about something they're unhappy with. And, you know, that's really what that is. A PP meeting is inter-party business, whereas a cabinet meeting is literally where policy is decided and decisions are made that affect the literal future and day-to-day lives of people. And, you know, and they can also, if there's cabinet leaks, I mean, they can also be quite, you know, damaging and hurtful because we saw the fallout from the cabinet leak around the Mother and Babies Homes Commission report that information got out into the public domain before various people, you know, actually involved in that received a briefing. So there are real life consequences of this as well. But I mean, it is an extraordinary story and, you know, it does have, and I'm just sort of staying on the political thing rather than kind of going into the Catherine Supones, the actual sort of meat of it.
We'll try and get to that in a minute.
Yeah. So, you know, because it does, I mean, A, for a start, you know, it's the government probably thought they'd got over the line of the summer recess, you know, without last year's Galtgate sort of style debacle. Mm. And here we are again.
But, you know, August is young. August is only 11 hours old. So there's plenty of time yet.
The month is Buttercup. But, you know, once again, they're sort of facing into an August. And August is a very dodgy month for politicians because, as you pointed out earlier on, you know, normally it marks the start of the silly season where a lot of, you know, the serious politics and serious news stories tend to abate because the courts are closed and a lot of stuff closes up. And it means that quite often a story, a fairly minor political story that normally wouldn't gain legs, you know, particularly in a busy day. Next thing, because of a dearth of anything else to write and talk about, the story just is everywhere. So it's bad timing from the point of view of government that are trying to put out stability. They've been heavily spinning over the last month or so that this coalition has now settled down. It's in a very stable place that, you know, they're getting things done. And now this just, you know, and it brings with all its kind of negative connotations of, you know, accusations of cronyism and miscommunication at best and arrogance at worst. So it's not a great look for a government facing into the summer recess.
John, one thing which is quite striking about this, and I've seen this being pointed out pretty heavily on Twitter already this morning, that even when you read the first paragraph of this Sunday Independent story, Leo Varadkar has questioned a cabinet minister believed to be behind a damaging government leak. A lot of people pointing out that that might be a textbook definition of irony, given some of the difficulties that Leo Varadkar has had in the last year about his handling of confidential information.
Indeed. And I think what jumped out at me about that is that this looks like maybe an internal Fine Gael problem. I mean, that the signal to me was, well, he wouldn't be dressing down someone outside his own party. Well, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I mean,
he's not the Taoiseach, so maybe he wouldn't have authority to do
so. Exactly. Anyway, yeah, exactly. So in my head, I just ran down, you know, who are the Fine Gael ministers that he might have been talking to, and there aren't really many to choose from.
No.
So I thought, okay, it's the internal politics of Fine Gael are kind of bleeding through into you know, cabinet's stability, which is kind of a problem. But it's also been Leo Varadkar's MO to create to put himself at the center of these kind of stories, I think, from the start.
Is this where things become material, though? And people suggested that Leo Varadkar had gotten out the gap. I know there's still a pending criminal investigation into his handling of that IMO contract and the people with whom he shared it. But it was pointed out at the time, and I will take credit as being one of the people who made the observation, that this was now going to forever tarnish Leo Varadkar, and that the next time he had to be a cabinet disciplinarian, whether it was merely as Taoiseach or potentially as Taoiseach again in a little over 12 months, that his ability to impose discipline would be undermined by the fact that his own copybook had now been blotted. And this seems to be a textbook example of where that's the case.
Indeed. And when you read through the story, you know, you find the ruse is presented as a kind of, final proof that this minister is the leaker. It only proves that this minister has leaked. It doesn't prove that this minister leaked this specific information necessarily. Mm. Perhaps if Leo had a bit more authority, this minister wouldn't be as quick to, you know, deny it after being caught that easily. So look, these stories, and I guess we are in August, as we said, it's a cabinet intrigue story, which has one serious element, I think, which is confidentiality. I'm not sure it's that important to the average person, like who's up and who's down in Fine Gael, and is like this minister mean to that minister. Like I'm a journalist and I don't even care about that stuff. Mm. So there's a lot of
It strikes me as being slightly churlish for journalists to complain about leaks, because it's kind of our currency in trade, really. Yeah.
Well, there's the right kind of leak and the wrong kind of leak, Gavin. So
it's a leak you get and a leak you don't get.
Yeah, exactly.
Part of the, if people are wondering, by the way, why we mightn't be speculating as to the names, and John has pointed out there's a pretty short list of who might be doing it. If you look at the fine print of the Official Secrets Act of 1963, Section 4 makes it an offence to communicate any official information to another person unless you're duly authorised to do so. And that's where you get into the whole row about whether a decision already made by Cabinet, but while Cabinet is still underway, whether it's appropriate to communicate that onwards. Lise, I suppose to maybe draw a bit of a line in, to cap the discussion on this, people can see this as just being a bit of political theatre, and people might also then see it as being outrageous and scurrilous that there might be someone who's maybe acting in bad faith or being leaky from the Cabinet table, where people need to have that level of confidence. To people who think that this is a bit of a nothing story or a bubble story, what do you say back to them?
Well, I think that, again, it's anything that reinforces the public belief that, well, I mean, there's sort of two elements of it. I mean, you know, we've talked about the Cabinet confidentiality, but just the whole sort of system of how appointments are done, how business is done, you know, that is serious, because anything that reinforces, you know, the cynic's belief that everything is a fit up, everything is a stitch up, it's always jobs for the boys or the women in this case.
It hasn't done much to dispel that.
No, it really hasn't done much to dispel this. And again, you know, we've already had a sort of a row in recent history, you know, obviously around Seamus Wolfe. Mm. And again, this sort of, you know, Fine Gael tried to sort of pass it off as, oh, look, it was a miscommunication and we should have had it in. You know, there was loads of things on the Cabinet agenda, and it just kind of slipped under the wire. But that sort of can be perceived in some quarters as stroke politics, what could be, perceived in some quarters as cronyism, though it could be argued that Catherine Zavone was very much an independent operator. And there's an excellent piece by Michael Brennan on just how much of a kind of an independent operator she has been. Yeah. So the sort of cronyism thing isn't necessarily true.
Yeah.
But it really isn't a good look. You know, if you're trying to say that we are doing things in an open and transparent manner, we've seen that the vaccine, just going back to the vaccine rollout, we have seen that when everything is done in a transparent manner and people are informed and brought along and understand the process, whether it's a political appointment or a vaccine rollout, people get on board.
Yeah.
And if you have another example of an appointment that seems to have made,
And if they could also get their story straight about who opposed who or how exactly was the whole idea come up with.
It's not a great look having two senior ministers disagree on the sort of, who told who. Who, what, and when the decisions were made on air.
And it's a shame that we can't delve a little bit more into that, because the scrutiny about exactly how Catherine Zappone managed to find a UN-oriented job for herself, having expressed availability, and then suddenly a job was made with her in mind, but not necessarily made for her. It's a nuance for what it's important, but we don't have time to get into it. Very, very briefly, because I do have to take a break before the news. In a sentence, MTV is 40 years old today, talking about it with Donald Fallon later. Lise, your MTV song, the song that you can't hear without thinking of the video because of MTV.
Has to be Rio, Duran Duran. Simply because it was just sort of yachts and hair flowing in the wind and outrageous outfits, and I literally cannot hear that song without thinking about that. Yeah.
So that's what goes on in Lisa's head when she chews out for a minute or two. John, very briefly, your MTV song.
For me, it's Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles, which I believe was the
first
one to be
ever
broadcast.
Played. Yeah, indeed. More about the history of MTV with Donald Fallon a little bit later. For now, John Isle, Lise Hand, thank you both very much for coming in to talk to me.
On the record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk.